Hello and welcome to episode 46 of the Right Dishonourable podcast. I am Jimmy Nichols and I'm joined this week not by Jazza John, my usual co-host. I'm joined by John Cervante. John, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm here doing this podcast with you as opposed to off doing salacious things like Jazza.
We'll leave that suggestion hanging in the ether. As per usual, we are going to be talking about politics, current affairs, news and all that juff. We have, as per usual, three topics for you this week. John, the first one that we will be talking about is the happenings of the NUS. Could you briefly run down what's going on in that region?
Basically there's a new president of the NUS, Malalia
Bhatia.
I've probably completely murdered that. She's a bit of a controversial figure for some allegedly anti-Semitic remarks. This has caused a backlash across the country, with different student unions now debating whether they should disaffiliate from the NUS. Lincoln already has. My university has just had a vote on it. Other universities supposedly might have votes on it by the end of the year or at the beginning of the next academic year. So. Yeah, it's interesting. It's the breakup of a big union, potentially.
Potentially. I mean, we're going to be talking about free speech and some of the other issues pertaining to student politics at the moment. And that is the first segment. The second segment, we are going to be talking about the refugee crisis, but we're going to take a slightly different angle on it. John, who is the figure we're going to be focusing on initially in that segment?
Sir Nicholas Winton, who actually died a year ago, but a memorial for him was held this week. He was a man who in 1939 was responsible for the transport of 669 children from Czechoslovakia to Britain through what was called Operation Kinder Transport, or the Kinder Transport Operation. He saved the lives of a lot of children who were predominantly Jewish and therefore would have probably been sent to camps like Auschwitz by the Nazis. The memorial was held in London, attended by some of the children that he sort of saved. He was a very modest man, which we'll talk about. Subsequently, some of the people who attended his memorial went over to the Calais jungle to make a sort of political point about the current refugee crisis in Europe.
So that is our second topic. And to round things off, we are going to be talking about the EU referendum, just a roundup of some of the things that have happened in the past week, and our thoughts on how the campaign is going more generally. So, John, I think in a moment I'm going to play the music. Do you have anything else you'd like to say before we start?
No, only that I'm, again, very interested in what Jazza may or may not be up to right now.
So earlier this year, Malalia Bhatia was elected as the new president of the NUS, which is the National Union of Students. And it's caused quite a lot of controversy because she's expressed a lot of, I think, what mainstream politicians and certainly mainstream political journalists would regard as very left-field views, particularly in relation to anti-Semitism and the problem of anti-Semitism within the left more generally, and also her feelings about Israel and anti-Zionism. And it's, as a story, it's kind of captured this sense that student politics has gone a bit adrift and has become quite radicalised and has sort of fitted into this almost like a Jeremy Corbyn kind of view of the left, of like the hard left has not only is kind of gripping student politics at the moment. And John, you wrote an article recently about Warwick's vote on disaffiliation from the NUS. That's Warwick University's vote. And I just wanted, you had like a main headline point from that I wanted you to elaborate on a bit.
Yeah, firstly, just to clear up one or two things that you said, just in case they weren't fully clear for listeners. the new president of the NUP, I'm not going to say her name because I'm bound to butcher the pronunciation.
I probably already have done, so.
Yeah, but, you know, she's allegedly called, I'm not sure how alleged this is, by the way, because I'm sure that this has appeared in print somewhere, but because it appears everywhere, these exact quotes. Anyway, everybody keeps saying allegedly for some reason. She called the university, allegedly, called the University of Birmingham something of a Zionist outpost.
She did say that. Yeah, that is that, that's certainly something she said.
Yeah, said that the British media are Zionist-led. And she's, you know, she's sort of... her rebuttal to criticism has been that people have a problem with her as a Muslim woman being in a position of power. So
I didn't even realise she was Muslim. So I'm certainly not sure how true that is.
Yeah, well, the thing that I find amazing about this was Ken Livingstone was fucked for saying one thing that, you know, even the Jewish Socialist Society, or Jewish Socialist Party, one of the two of Great Britain, came out and said, well, there's nothing wrong with what he said. And yet she has somehow got away with saying she hasn't got away with it. It's causing a shitstorm now.
To be fair, in the grand scheme of things, Ken Livingstone is one of the foremost Labour politicians in the country, whereas she's not anyone particularly important. She just happens to head up the NUS, which does attract quite a lot of media attention. But in terms of people's general lives, she's not that important.
I mean... I don't. To a degree, I argue that she's important because she has, you know, influence over the views of young people, whereas who necessarily gives a fuck about Ken Livingstone? Anyway, that's a whole separate argument. That's me being quite cynical.
So what was the main point you made in your article about this vote?
Getting back to this bore article I wrote, which is the Warwick student newspaper. So there was a Huffington Post blog done by a former sabbatical student union officer at Warwick called Lucy Gill. And to me, my reading of Lucy's article was very much that she was attacking anybody who wanted to vote Leave as a right-wing student. And she definitely does.
That was to leave the NUS, you should clarify.
There's an exact quote from her article. She says, there is clearly considerable irony in a group of right-wing activists so frequently critical of boycotts, walkouts and safe spaces, now attempting to essentially no-platform the NUS for deeply partisan reasons. To me, that reads as very much sort of suggesting that anybody who wanted to vote to disaffiliate was part of what she names right-wing activists. Now, I'm not right-wing. I'm definitely left-wing. I voted to disaffiliate on the grounds that I don't agree with the no-platform policy. I think it's an affront to free speech. You know, you can argue for the merits of it being democratic because, you know, what NUS conferences vote on, there's some statistic like they're 0.1% of the actual every member of the NUS, and the NUS to this day refuse a one member one vote system. So you can argue that it's perhaps not democratic, although some people argue that it is. Anyway, I don't agree with no platforming, and I was quite single issue on my wanting to leave the NUS. I think that having now coming to the end of my time at university, free speech for me has been a very real problem. I don't like the way that our generation somehow conflate worrying about free speech with being anti-progressive or non-progressive. I think they do conflate worrying about free speech with being anti-progressive or non-progressive. And I think this...
So you're saying people who advocate for free speech are viewed as right-wing by students?
Oh, I mean, my God, I am every time I bring it up.
So there's actually, just on a side note to kind of support your general point, there's actually a survey that came up from the Higher Education Policy Institute only today, which shows that 3/4 of students at British universities would ban, quote, no platform speakers with offensive views, which does kind of play into your point that a lot of students do have a problem with free speech.
And yet a lot of them, you know, what was it, 4/5 of them in another question said they don't feel there's any problem with airing their political views.
Yeah, but that suggests there's a hive mind effect going on there.
Yeah, but you know, there's that is in within one report. There is a piercing irony that students feel that they have the right to free speech, and yet they want to ban people with offensive views. Well, that doesn't quite add up. I think it's a real problem. I could make so many different arguments around this, and there are many people who've made them much better than I ever will. If you go look up, you know, Christopher Hitchens, he makes some fantastic arguments about this. So does Stephen Fry.
Christopher Hitchens was an Anglo-American journalist, who aren't aware.
So does Stephen Fry, who's a sort of, he's kind of a jack of all trades, he's an actor.
He's a British comedian originally.
Yeah, British comedian originally. If you go look up any of the sort of charities who work on this kind of stuff, like the Index for Censorship or English Pen or Article 19, they variously talk about it and have a lot of different publications. I mean, the long and short of it for me is who gets to decide, you know, there's this whole thing about we're banning harmful views. Because we don't want harmful views in universities, and we don't want students at university to be exposed to harmful views. We want to protect them from it. To me, that's dangerous because it sets a precedent. Who gets to decide what views are harmful? Somebody brought up to me this week that there is a law this is totally true, and I was aware of this before they brought it up to me, but they brought it up in an argument. There's a law, the Prevent Initiative, which is meant to sort of curb extremism in university by stopping anybody with sort of extremist or terrorist views coming onto campuses and speaking. I don't agree with that, because I don't agree with the government having the right to sort of declare people harmful. And by the same token, I don't think students should be naive platforming people because they think that their views are harmful. There are many instances of where this goes wrong, and you know, people argue, usually it's just a bureaucratic oversight. There was Mayam Namazi,
Mariam
Namazi, was banned at Warwick for a few weeks. That was then sort of everybody apologised, and it was meant to. I'm sceptical about whether that was bureaucratic oversight.
I don't believe it was. I think it was. Even if that instance was an administrative mistake, if you can believe that, there's certainly been other instances of speakers being banned.
There are numerous other instances, and there are instances in American universities now of things like plays being banned from being put on because they have a so-called triggering content.
Triggering content, for those who aren't aware, is upsetting content, whether it be sort of depictions of rape, or it's rarely depictions of murder for some reason. That's never really considered triggering, as far as I'm aware, but it's anything that could be upsetting and trigger bad memories or emotions in the audience.
The problem with banning people for wanting to talk about things that essentially whatever any individual or group says can be found offensive by someone. If you say something quite calmly left-wing, a right-wing person can take against it and say, I'm offended. And the problem with our generation is that saying I'm offended has become like an unanswerable argument to shutting somebody up. And to me, that's quite unacceptable. And, you know, coming out of the end of 5 years at university now, I have a real problem with how our generation don't actually accept the idea of political pluralism. They really don't. They love confirmation bias. They love it in their own social circles. They love it. The internet's a brilliant place for confirmation bias because, you know, whether you're left-wing, right-wing, a nerd, a geek, a feminist, whatever, you don't have to ever acknowledge the existence of other sets of people. You can go online and just pretend that you are the only sort of person with that political view in the entire world. and you can shut yourself off. And the problem with that is that it doesn't lead to multiculturalism, it doesn't lead to diversity, it leads to essentialism. And academics around the world are looking at this.
So what do you mean by essentialism?
So essentialism is basically when you have a view of the world that kind of is narrow and doesn't go beyond your own personal experiences and views, and you can't really understand other people's experiences or views. And academics around the world are looking at the rise of this now, and there's various different evidence for this across different, spheres. There's the rise in right-wing nationalism across the world, which some academics have linked to this rise in essentialism and anti-pluralism. There's YouTube trolling, even down to, some people argue extreme left-wing politics and the way, extreme left-wing activists will attack lesser left-wing activists.
Well, you could even argue that the way Jeremy Corbyn supporters have treated other people online.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
exactly what I'm talking about.
But I do wonder if, despite having just cited some data which does confirm this is a problem for our generation, as it were. I think there are taboos in every generation, and it just so happens that our one's kind of fixated on certain political elements. But I do wonder if we are substantially less tolerant than the previous generation. And there's obviously certain ways in which we're more tolerant than the previous generation. We're more accepting of sexual minorities, for instance. So is this just a matter of emphasis?
I mean, what frightens me so much is if you look historically at movements in universities, they tend to mature into movements that affect the general population. You see this with the new wave comedy of the 80s. That was born out of people on campuses being outraged with, a lack of feminism, misogynistic comedy, racist comedy. New wave comedy evolved out of a lot of those political movements.
Is this in the UK you're talking about?
Specifically in the UK.
So what would be an example of a new wave comedian?
Ben Elton was a very famous one. Joe Brand, I think, was part of New Wave Comedy as well. It was people who kind of, most of them cited rebellion against people like Bernard Manning, who famously used to make very racist jokes. That was their kind of ethos, right? They wanted to bring more of a left-wing and progressive sensibility into comedy, and successfully so, I might add. If you look even earlier, there was the Berkeley movement in America in the late 1960s, which was, ended up having massive ripple effects in American culture in terms of free speech and free love and liberty and sort of hippie culture and all that kind of stuff.
So your point is that the trends, the social trends we see at universities, can percolate into the mainstream culture.
Exactly, and I'm that terrifies me as somebody leaving university, because I don't want to live in a society where pluralism falls away and confirmation bias becomes more and more of a problem, and where passive censorship becomes something that we accept. Because people don't fully appreciate the ramifications of different things. For example, you're seeing it at the moment with diversity in Hollywood, right? There are a lot of arguments going on around whitewashing and things like that. Now, just this weekend, or this week rather, over in America, Neighbours 2, Sorority Rising, came out. And this film is apparently quite fantastically feminist in the sense that there's like an equal screen time between men and women. Men and women are sort of equally funny, and they're both kind of equally looked at in a sort of disfavorable ways. It's meant to be quite an equal movie in terms of how it represents the sexes. And whilst it's been celebrated for that, it's now received a lot of backlash in Hollywood trades because none of the writers were female. So essentially what they're saying is that the product was fine, but the fact that there were no female staff writers on the movie is deplorable and means nobody should go see it. that is an example of essentialism, because, you know, think of where that logically leads to. It means that, for example, cis white male writers can only write cis white male characters and cis white male situations. Black writers can only write black characters and black situations. Women writers can only write women characters and situations. These are like the sort of logical endpoints for these kind of movements. And the problem with that is that if that happens, art dies. And that's just a terrifying idea, really. The idea that
In the case of films, I realise that would also be a problem for books. But in the case of films, wouldn't it actually be possible to put together a demographically diverse team, and therefore build up a story that actually touched on, or a film that touched on, all of the different demographics that were needed to be touched on?
Yeah, I mean, I've got no problem with there being diversity behind. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying for a second there shouldn't be diversity behind or in front of the camera. No problem with that whatsoever. I think it's a good thing. I think society is diverse. Art is supposed to reflect society anyway. Therefore, you know, art should be diverse. But you can't start putting limitations on things and saying, well, this is a good script, but we're not going to put any money into it or let it be produced because, you know, you're a man and you've written about women's issues here, so sorry, we're going to jettison this. That to me seems absolutely ridiculous. There's a specific case I always cite when I have these debates with people. Steve McQueen, who's a black British filmmaker, writer and director, a few years ago did a film called Hunger about the Northern Irish Troubles. Now, there are so many levels on which Steve McQueen shouldn't have made that film. You know, he's black talking about white issues. Most importantly, he is a British male talking about the conflict in Northern Ireland.
I realise we've discussed this example before, but I feel the British example is always erroneous, or rings false to me, because in the minds of social justice warriors and identitarians and people who think in the way that you're attacking, his blackness would supersede his Britishness, if you see what I mean. It would be different if like I was writing that film or directing that film as a white British male compared to a black British male. It doesn't really count.
I mean, tell that to a member of Sinn Féin. Say to Sinn Féin, do you think it's all right that a film about the Troubles was directed by a British person? And they'll tell you to fuck off.
Yeah, but if they knew he was black British, it wouldn't be the same.
I don't think that would change it at all.
There was an instance recently where I'm sure it was a member of Sinn Féin tweeted something about Django Unchained, and he used the word nigger, and this whole thing blew up. But
that was
Gerry Adams. It is a phrase in Irish politics that Irishmen are the niggers of Europe, and I don't think in some ways I think that example works, and in other ways I don't think it works. And the British thing is, for me, just rings false. I don't think it would be understood in the way that you think it would.
The other point is that, you know, somebody said to me a little while ago, there was that film that came out, Suffragette, and they said if it had been written, I don't know who it was written by, to be fair, but if it had been directed by a man, they wouldn't have gone to see it. What, you know, that completely throws out the idea of gender fluidity, for one thing. And secondly, you have all kinds of problems with trans when you say things like that.
But leaving that aside, do they not have a point that if there is no opportunity to apply pressure in the form of like economic boycotts is kind of what we're talking about, that actually limits their ability to create more diversity behind and in front of the camera, as you put it?
No, I think that's absolutely ridiculous, because
I mean, from a purely strategic point of view, I'm not asking you to judge this from a moral point of view. It does make sense that boycotting could be an efficient tactic to actually affect the change that they want. Isn't that true?
What, boycott? So you're saying, for example, by boycotting Neighbours too, we could help, you know.
I'm saying that if people continually boycott films that do not have a diverse team behind them, it will send an economic message to the creators of said films that this is no longer something that the consumer finds acceptable.
But yeah, but sorry, what is it that the consumer is not meant to find acceptable? The idea that men can write about women's issues, or women can write about men's issues, or black people can write about white people's issues.
I'm not saying I support that from a moral point of view.
No,
I'm saying from a tactical point of view, it makes perfect sense.
From a tactical point of view, you are doing absolutely nothing. From a tactical point of view, you're boycotting movies based on this sort of false assumption that by refusing to give studios your dollars or pounds, they're going to have to increase diversity behind the camera. That's not what you're actually saying by boycotting movies. You might think that's what you're saying. What you're actually saying is, let's move to an essentialist sort of Nazi propaganda state of art where races can only talk about their own race, where genders can only talk about their own genders, where we get rid of gender fluidity, where we can never film another Shakespeare play as a movie. We might as well ban Henrik Ibsen and Sean O'Casey and any writer who's ever represented women favourably in their plays because, you know, they're male and they obviously didn't have a clue. And we're just going to, you know, go backwards in terms of society. We can forget multiculturalism, we can forget political pluralism, we can forget gender fluidity, and we can just all go back to sort of living in caves, and where we have this sort of tribal system of, well, you're white, so you're allowed in, but you're black, you're meant to be over in the black lands.
And on that bombshell, we've gone all the way from the NUS to some sort of cultural Nazi state, but we have like run somewhat over for this top segment, so I'm going to call an end to it, and we are going to move on to the next bit.
Okay, so in the past week there has been a memorial service held for Sir Nicholas Winton. Sir Nicholas Winton was a man who is responsible for saving 669 mostly Jewish children from Czechoslovakia in 1939 on something he organised called Kinder Transport. He died actually last year at the age of 106, but due to the fact that many of the children that he saved are obviously sort of scattered by now, and also elderly, they decided basically to hold the memorial service all this time later to give people the chance to make it along. 28 of the children attended the memorial service along with 400 other people, including Czech, Slovak and UK government representatives. Sir Nicholas Winton actually kept very quiet about what he had done for many, many years. And it wasn't really until 1988 on the Esther Ranson programme, That's Life, that the public became aware of what he'd done. There's a very touching moment you can look up on YouTube where he had no idea what was going on. He thought he was there to, he was going to a BBC programme to sort of celebrate somebody else's life, and he'd been invited along. And there's a moment that Esther Ranson says, if you owe your life to Sir Nicholas Winton, please stand up, and sort of the entire audience gets up and he kind of bursts into tears. So I imagine you sort of would see all of these sort of grown-ups around him who kind of owe their lives to him.
Wow.
As a kind of footnote to this, a few days after the memorial, a few of the children and his son and some other sort of people from the 400 who went along to the memorial went over to the Calais jungle in order to meet with...
What is the Calais jungle for those who aren't aware?
The Calais jungle, for those who don't know, it's basically a kind of ad hoc refugee camp that has been set up by refugees trying to get over into the UK. They kind of people who went to the memorial went over to the Calais jungle kind of as a political statement about letting in Syrian immigrants in general, but also
non-Syrian immigrants and refugees.
Oh, yeah, also non-Syrian, but also more specifically to kind of challenge the government's policy on allowing unaccompanied children from mainland Europe and Syria into the country, which a few weeks ago they voted down, and they've since kind of tried to backtrack on it a bit, although they've been quite non-specific about their backtracking.
So obviously the story about Nicholas Winton is particularly pertinent because of the refugee crisis, which has been ongoing for, I don't know, I suppose it's the best part of a year at this point. It's definitely something that we've talked about over the course of the past year. Do you think it actually is that salient in terms of the British public's general attitude to migration, which tends to be fairly hostile?
I mean, I don't think, to be fair, I don't think it's just British people's attitudes. It's kind of proven that this is happening all across Europe. Everybody is kind of, there is a rise in right-wing nationalism. Nobody really wants to let immigrants in, which is quite, it just, obviously, probably anybody with a history background would have thought of this before now. I did, it kind of lent an air of particular irony for me that seeing this news story that everybody is moaning and there is such a rise in right-wing nationalism, considering so much immigration went on after the Second World War, so much that we kind of look back on now with a sort of pride of how humanitarian it all was. And we're not doing, I apparently there were problems back then. There definitely are problems now.
Well,
People
people
aren't.
often make the point that there was a lot of hostility to Jewish migration to the UK, both during and actually after World War II, which is actually one of the reasons why Britain and America worked to set up Israel.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm absolutely certain that's the case. I think historically, people are always a bit, regardless of culture, people are kind of, they have a tendency to fear immigrants, for different reasons, dilution of culture, taking of jobs, effect on economy, things like that. But I suppose people like me have kind of been, calling or talking about viewing this in more of a humanitarian mode, I suppose, as sort of a humanitarian crisis. I mean, we were talking about this a few weeks ago. I got particularly upset about the Tories initially voting down the amendment to the bill to take in, I think it was 3,000. It was something. There was like a definite number of unaccompanied children that was proposed.
I think it was 3,000,
I
if
think
I,
it
yeah.
was 3,000, and they voted it down. I found that particularly distressing because there are charities that have said, they have no accurate way of knowing how many of these children have been already sold into things like sex trafficking and child slavery. I think Amnesty International was one of them. I'm certain there are a few children's charities who brought out reports about this, and obviously they're all conflicting because nobody necessarily has accurate data. But the problem is that everybody's kind of saying this is someone else's problem, as opposed to just going, well, I mean, I can
Well,
it's being.
some of the children, specifically in this group of 3,000, it should be said that across Europe, it's been estimated that there are 50,000 unaccompanied minors, I should say. Like, children makes it sound as though they're all between the ages of 0 and 12, but some of them
Yeah,
are definitely a bit older than that.
yeah, and indeed, there has been the point raised that how, because this does include children up to 18, how can you prove that a lot of these people haven't got documents on them? How can you prove that they are teenagers and just not just very young-looking young adults? But
I don't see that latter thing as so much of a problem, although I think the language is a bit mendacious for the reasons I just said. Like, a 17-year-old isn't a child, really, by anyone's certainly by the way normal people use language. That is a bit duplicitous. But the wider point I was going to make is that of the 3,000 children, they seem like, from the articles I've read, they're predominantly located in Greece, Italy, and France. Now, I don't really see why we should be dealing with children and minors who are already in France, from my point of view. It seems to me that France is just as well equipped as we are to deal with them. And obviously, if they're already in France, it makes sense to deal with them in France.
The problem with saying that, though, is it's a bit of a facile thing to say, especially in light of everybody else is saying exactly the same fucking thing.
Well, I don't know. Presumably, the French are not saying, well, these people are in France, therefore we should deal with them.
I mean, quite literally, if you look up some of the articles, this is kind of what every country is saying at the moment, is it's not our problem, and you know, this should be somebody else's problem, and this is one of the things that charities are complaining about, the fact that, you know, nobody is just saying, look, we have a problem with minors on the continent, we need to get them somewhere safe because they are being picked off by, you know, sex traffickers and child enslavers. I mean, it's one thing to be hostile towards adults. Surely, just from a moral standpoint, we shouldn't be passe about the idea that any of these children get sold into sex slavery. That's surely got to be, I mean, in some ways, you know, a fate worse than death, to be taken away as, say, an 8 or 9 year old and made to have sex with what one can only imagine a disgusting, immoral, you know, perverted people.
Well, there's even agreeing with what you've just said about the moral point, there is a pragmatic point, which is that there's a limited amount of money for things like foreign aid and charity, which is essentially what we're talking about. And it isn't unreasonable to say, well, look, some of these minors and kids are already in developed countries such as France and Italy. The Greece point is obviously different because of Greece's specific financial situation, but France and Italy are first world countries. They should be able to deal with this sort of problem. There's a problem around, I guess you could call it, governance, in the sense that the EU has failed to grapple with this issue specifically, but actually just more generally, like the migration crisis. And I do agree that's bad, but it doesn't seem to me to be something that Britain can solve unilaterally. It seems to be something that would actually require a deal of collaboration, which, given some of the arguments that countries such as Hungary and Austria are having around migration in general, would be very contentious, I think.
I mean, I don't deny that. It's obviously a conversation people aren't particularly comfortable having, especially, apart from anything else, with the rise of right-wing nationalism in Europe, I suppose nobody at the moment no government wants to be seen to going, well, we'll accept the immigrants, because that's going to hurt their re-election chances, apart from anything else. But as I said, there is a distinction between immigrants generally and unaccompanied immigrant children, surely, from a moral point of view.
So does that mean that hypothetically you would agree to take on all of the children around the world who live in dangerous countries?
Well, I mean, that's a slightly extremist argument, isn't it? Because we are talking about a specific instance here where...
Sure, but you've said that children are exceptional in this regard. That you said that they're exempt from the usual restrictions that we would consider to be appropriate for immigration.
I think they are, because there's a different... For example, the same exception, I think, would apply to disabled people. You're talking about people who aren't fully able to look after themselves without the help and care of others. In the case of disabled people, I mean, it depends on the disability, but you know, in particularly difficult cases, they might need carers, they might need special equipment or medication, you know, forms of medical help that they're not going to get if they're, you know, going around refugee camps or trying to travel from country to country.
I think that's a good analogy, because it is about the ability to care for oneself. But the same argument does seem to apply. Are you saying that we have a responsibility to take on all disabled people from around the world? Because I don't think you would think that, and therefore what the argument is, what sort of criteria are we using to actually decide who it is we do and do not help?
I mean, we personally, as in the UK,
do the we UK, have yeah.
Do we have a responsibility towards every child in need and every disabled person in the world? Obviously, the realistic financial answer has to be no, because no one country can shoulder that entire burden. You're right in the sense as well that this needs to be something that is done in a sort of communicative way with other countries in the EU in terms of the children that we're talking about now. It can't just be the UK, it needs to be other countries. And I'm not suggesting the UK should just say fuck it, we'll take all of them. I do think though that this is maybe one of those situations where you could set off sort of a domino effect. If you're the first country that says, you know what, we'll agree to take X number of children, we'll do it, we hope that other countries will follow our lead, that might start to actually happen. Because once one person or one group sort of tries to show the moral lead, I think it will put more pressure on other countries to follow.
But Germany has actually followed exactly that strategy, not for children, but for just migrants and refugees in general, and it hasn't created that effect. If anything, I would say it actually created the opposite effect. It actually stirred up a great deal of hostility.
I think there is a distinction between children and immigrants. You know,
I don't think other people would see that distinction necessarily.
I think I'll tell you why I'm right in saying that. Look at what happened with, I know we've kind of regressed a bit now, but look at what happened with the pictures of Island Kurdi last summer. The second those came out, the next day they were across every major newspaper in the UK, and suddenly everybody had much more sympathy and time for the plight.
I don't think they did. I seem to recall the data at the time, the polling data suggested there wasn't a great surge of sympathy, actually. It was... The reason that photo featured on newspapers across the world is because it was, from a journalistic point of view, a great photo. It was immensely evocative. But in terms of it actually having an effect on public opinion, you tend to find that most news events do not massively sway people's opinions one way or the other. It tends to be an aggregated effect, and people's opinions move very gradually.
See, I might be wrong. I personally think... it's been a long time now, it's been a year, but I thought I saw a poll come out that indicated precisely the opposite, that photo had swayed people's opinions, and what to me ended up swaying them more aggressively sort of towards, you know, no immigrants or migrants at all, was the sort of the second Paris attacks. Because I remember saying at the time of the Paris attacks that any progress we'd made because of the tragic pictures of Island Kurdi was going to be completely undone, which I think to a large degree it was.
No, listen, I'm a bit sceptical that is actually how these sort of events work. It is true that when you survey people, if you prompt people with some sort of talking point, so if you say to people, are you in favour of taking on Syrian refugees? You'll get a different response from if you say, do you remember this photo of the child washed up on the beach? If you prompt them with that memory, you will get a slightly different response than when you ask them then, what are your feelings about migration from Syria and so on. So I suppose, but in general terms, I don't think news events are actually that important in long-term opinion forming, but we've kind of run to the end of the time for this segment, so if you agree with me or agree with John, get in touch via @rightdishonour at Twitter, or you can go on rightdishonour.com and
just to interrupt you there, if you agree with me, please write to your local MP, or at least tweet your local MP, because I mean, from my point of view, this is an important issue. If you don't agree, fine. But if you do, don't bother with comments. Just tweet your local MP.
Thanks, John. I'm trying to, you know, build up a profile for us here, and you're just ruining it. So a lot's happened in the past few weeks since we last talked about the EU referendum, which is happening on June 23rd. Lots of to-ins and fro-ings between the various camps, the Remain camp, who's obviously headed by the likes of David Cameron and, to a lesser extent, Alan Johnson of the Labour Party, the former Home Secretary, and the Outcamp, which is headed by Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, both members of the Tory cabinet, and to a lesser extent, people like Nigel Farage. The most recent happening, something that's just blown up today, is about Britain's ability to influence Turkish membership of the EU, which is an issue that's been ongoing for at least the last decade, probably a bit longer. When will Turkey actually be allowed to join the EU? It's been promised various things. Most recently, its citizens have been offered visa-free travel, so effectively a free ability to move within the EU, not for work, just for like tourism purposes and that sort of thing, as part of the deal to actually get Turkey to help out with the migration crisis, which we've obviously touched on elsewhere in this podcast. John, what do you make of how firstly of this Turkish story, but also how the referendum debate is shaping up more generally?
I mean, I think Turkey is a contentious issue in and of itself. Obviously, there are many people. Turkey has a pretty, how should we say, dubious record on human rights at the
I
moment.
think that would be putting it mildly, to be honest, but what
Yeah,
do you mean by that?
well, there are suggestions if you go look up things on, for example, the index on censorship, that there are frequent suggestions that journalists get censored, threatened, even murdered for, well, allegedly murdered for standing up to the state. It's kind of a tyrannical, I forget, is it president or prime minister they have over there?
It's President Erdogan.
See, Erdogan is definitely sort of accused of basically being a tyrannical dictator.
Yeah, so he's accused of eroding the constitutional checks and balances, which mean that a president is somewhat restricted in their ability to control the government, basically. And there's a lot of evidence that he has done that, and he's certainly eroded the powers of the press and the freedom of the press in Turkey.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if you speak to, well, English Pen have a whole sort of thing about this at the moment. They're very concerned with trying to sort of illuminate to the rest of the world some of the stuff that's going on in Turkey, specifically in terms of journalism and free speech. But if you'd speak to Turkish people who, are over here studying, for example, or have come over here for whatever reasons, they generally will say the same thing that we're not happy in Turkey and it's an oppressive, horrible regime, but we couldn't ever say that in Turkey for fear of, God knows what happening to us.
So obviously none of that is a particularly good fit for the EU. I mean, actually under EU rules, countries have to measure up to a certain amount of democratic standards before they're allowed to join. The idea being that you can promote human rights within countries outside of the EU, and in exchange, these countries get to join the EU and get all the benefits. Slightly contentious thing to say, I suppose, in the atmosphere of the EU referendum more generally. But that's broadly the idea, and I feel the reason Turkey is so contentious, apart from anything else, laying aside the human rights record, is actually because it's a Muslim majority country, and no countries within the EU and no countries outside of Albania within Europe are Muslim majority countries, I don't
Well,
think.
I mean, my admittedly limited understanding of this in terms of the EU is that obviously nobody is very happy with their human rights and free speech record at the moment. But nobody would mind having their economy being part of the EU. Is that sort of relatively correct?
Are you saying
Economically, it could actually be quite beneficial to the EU to have a trading partner in Turkey.
I think that's fair to say. The thing with economics, I think, is that in broader terms, the freer the trade, the bigger your economy grows. There's various arguments you can have about how the wealth is then distributed in a free trade society, but it seems putting up trade barriers and tariffs and that sort of thing generally creates less efficient trade, and that leads to lesser production of wealth, basically. So I think your point is not really contentious.
It's one of those situations to me that's, sort of like trade that we have with Russia and China. On the one hand, you kind of have to trade with them because they're major economic powers. On the other hand, you want to sanction them for, all of the dubious shit that goes on. Allegedly. To me, Turkey and the EU is another example of that. Cameron, what's the elaborate for me in terms of the veto? What is actually, because Cameron had to defend this today. What is the evidence sort of presented?
So the argument from the Brexit side is that if Britain remains within the EU, we will not be able to veto Turkey's membership. And excuse me, because Angela Merkel has kind of promised as part of her package of deals with Turkey that Turkey will the membership talks will be put back on the table. The thought is that Turkey will join the EU, and if Britain remains within the EU, we will be powerless to stop this, and then all of the 80 million Turkish people will therefore have the same access to Britain in terms of migration that everyone else does. And obviously, Turkey will have a role in decision making within the EU, which certainly the latter part of that is I think, is certainly bad, just because of Turkey's predisposition. But that said, there's a lot of countries in Europe, I've already named some of them, Austria. Actually, just this weekend, have elected a far-right government, and Hungary elected a far-right government. I think at the sort of towards the start of this year, might have been last year actually. But the point is that there's a lot of countries that are opposed to Turkey's membership anyway. So I think the argument that Turkey would be a shoe-in for a new, membership of the European Union is false. But yeah, that's the debate that's going on at this point.
I mean, the people over here, especially at the moment, are always going to get up in arms when they're presented with the idea that suddenly 80 million people in Turkey are going to move over here, because that is the kind of catastrophizing that British people do. Automatically, everybody wants to come to us, and all 80 million of those Turkish people will definitely move over here and not want to stay in Turkey. I think the bigger concern is, I suppose it's the idea of being able to veto somebody on the grounds of them not really allowing free speech or being democratic enough is appealing, from a left-wing point of view, because I suppose you'd sort of optimistically hope that if you veto somebody repeatedly or say that they can't join this club, that they'll clean up their act. But then again, as you said, it's been 10 years, and if anything, some would argue things have got much worse. So.
Well, I don't know if the. Well, yeah, in terms of the general direction of travel in Turkey, it has got worse. But the thing is that there are members within the EU who are also having problems along this line. No country in Europe, I think, has an immaculate record on freedom of speech. Certainly, I mean, you could even just look at it from a. You could talk about the whistleblowing of Edward Snowden, releasing all the files from the NSA about spying. And no country in Europe, to my knowledge, was actually willing to accept him as a refugee on the grounds that if he returned back to the US, he'd be persecuted. And for me, that is partly a free speech issue. You've also got things like, more immediately, countries like I've mentioned Hungary and Austria, but also Poland's government has also damaged the independence of the press in that country. So it seems to be that once you're inside the EU club, there isn't an awful lot that other EU countries are willing to do to actually force you to live up to the standards that you had to adhere to actually become a member. So it is all a bit rich. I want to cover some of the other headlines that have happened in the last week. So there's been a letter written, sorry, a column written in the Times today. We're recording this on Sunday, about how Brexit could damage the NHS. What's your. I think we're going to hear an awful lot of this about how leaving the EU is going to damage public services. Do you have any thoughts on this?
It's always an easy go-to, isn't it? The NHS. It's like a fucking political football you can throw into any argument. I mean, it's the kind of thing that makes me just switch off, to be honest, by this point, because every time there's an election about anything, it seems that the NHS gets brought up, often for really spurious reasons. Why did this column say that Brexit will affect the NHS?
Well, I think the argument is partly an economic one. Everyone says that the forecasts all seem to indicate that if Britain leaves the EU, there will be a short-term recession. I mean, Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, said earlier this week that there would be a technical recession, which means a lack of growth in GDP for 2 quarters. So essentially, your economy is shrinking for two quarters. If Britain left the EU, you need money from taxes to actually fund the NHS, and that goes for all public services. So that appears to be the main one. There's also arguments about immigration and Britain's ability to staff the NHS. So there seems to be some validity in all of these points. I don't know how you feel about it.
The one thing that I think is absolutely true is that we wouldn't necessarily be able to staff the NHS if we weren't in the EU.
But
I say that.
we could still have migration. We're assuming here that there'd be no freedom of movement between the EU and the UK if we left, which
I
is
mean,
probably a
isn't
fair
that kind
assumption.
of the point, though?
But
Yeah, exactly.
even if you don't have free movement, you can still have migration.
Well, I mean, you say that, but like, let's imagine a world in which we do leave the EU. So presumably Cameron has to step down. Probably somebody like Boris comes in. Almost definitely Boris comes in. Boris, probably because he's, supported by Nigel Farage and can pick up some votes from UKIP, probably takes a bit of a hard line
I
against
think that
the Brexit.
I think that's a bit I, that's false, I think. I mean, Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage are not really in the same
No,
club.
no, 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 no. I'm not saying they are at all. I'm saying that he could pick up some votes from UKIP if he decides to take a harder line on immigration, and he'll definitely keep all of his Brexit votership. So he'll probably choose to take a harder line on immigration because it seems to me, in terms of votership, it would make sense.
Johnson's not actually a particular hardliner in most of the respects that you would think of a Brexiteer. I mean,
No, I mean, I don't think
he's
he
really
is.
he's quite a cosmopolitan guy, really.
No, I quite agree, but surely it would make political sense if, Brexit does happen, for him to take over and say, okay, well, the people have spoken, let's, make the borders harder to cross.
Yeah, but I mean, harder to cross from free movement is you don't have to go very far. The argument from Farage has always been for an quote Australian style point system, and I
Yeah, which
think
has been proven not to really work anyway.
in what sense?
Well, despite the Australian point system, Australia still has a problem with immigration.
I mean, my understanding, like, that there's been an awful lot of criticism about Australia's handling of boat people, which is their phrase for refugees from Southeast Asia. But I understand they don't really have a problem with illegal migration, and that's partly a geographic thing. But I purely from like carrying out the intended aims of the policy, I understand the policy has been quite effective. I do understand, though, that they struggled to find, say, labour for their farms. So one of the conditions, if you move over to the US on a short-term working visa for a year or two, is that you work for 3 months on a farm or a couple of months on a farm anyway. And I think in certain respects they do struggle to find talented people. But then I think that's true of most first world economies to some degree. There is a desire for talent, say, in the medical professions or in the tech sector or whatever. I don't think that's a problem that's unique to Australia by any means.
Well, I mean, getting back to the NHS point, I think it would probably undoubtedly harm the NHS, probably mostly, I would argue, mostly in terms of staffing. It would cause a problem.
Okay,
Just
so
go on.
moving on to like the last topic, and then I in this segment, and then I think we will wrap up. This is a bit frivolous, but there was an open letter from 250 actors and worthies from the arts sector, saying that Britain
I
should
did see
remain
this.
within the EU. Well, one of our favourites, Benedict Cumberbatch, was among the signatories of this. I was going to say petition, but open letter would be right. Danny Boyle, Helena Bonham Carter, Dominic West, a couple of names on it. What do you make of this sort of
Like, don't
intervention?
get me wrong. So I think I'm probably going to vote Remain, which you might find surprising in light of, how I sort of don't really give a shit about some of these arguments. I'm probably going to vote Remain, but who gives a fuck about what somebody like Benedict Cumberbatch thinks? Like Benedict, no, like, because to be fair, as much as you or I or anybody else might agree or disagree with them, there are an awful lot of people, arguably predominantly working class in this country, who have a serious problem with the EU. Benedict Cumberbatch doesn't have a fucking clue what they think, because he's an old Etonian. He has no idea what the average British person, the average middle class even British person has to face in terms of, effects from the EU on a daily basis,
Are
because he's off.
you not slighting him for like purely classist reasons?
I mean, I am, but that's kind of the point. Why, as a group of very well-paid actors who spend half the year in America, probably at least anyway, do you think that what you say is going to affect the people who really need to hear something about, the people who really are undecided, or the people to whom this actually fucking matters?
So, if you were compiling a letter of people, there's been a couple of letters. There's been letters from business people and
I mean, I
various
think
other
they
groups.
were
Who
actually.
would you pick? Who would you choose to sign the letter? Who would you
I
want to
mean,
sign the letter?
I think some of the ones that have already gone are quite important. There was the letter from leading businesses in the UK, wasn't there? I think there was also one from, was it the Director of Institutes?
Yeah, so
Sorry,
there's been
Institute of
some there's
Directors.
been one from big business which backed remaining in the EU. There was one from smaller business which backed leaving the EU, which tallies with people's general perception of whether the EU is good and bad for what size of business. So yeah, there've already been some letters.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think that the important ones have kind of already been and gone, and made. I mean, actually, I was about to say didn't make much of an impact. I think they did, because, as much as the sort of Brexit tend to kind of try and shit on the whole Project Fear thing, the fact is that there are things to be, scared or legitimately worried about in terms of Britain leaving the EU, and I think that what people in sort of positions of, I suppose, knowledge, people like big businesses,
Authority, really.
authority, sorry, would be a better term. People of authority saying, well, actually, you should be worried about this, has clearly had an effect, because it's something that the media have covered. It's something that I think, the fact that it's being referred to as Project Fear, it is clearly having the effect of instilling fear in certain people, which you might argue that's really cynical and a bad mode of politics, but sometimes people need to take account of what it is you should be worried about. And if that translates into you yourself being fearful, unfortunate, because it's a negative emotion, but maybe you should be scared.
All right, on that note, we've run out of time, so I need to wrap this up. If you have any thoughts on any of the topics we've touched on, you can find the Right Dishonourable podcast at Right Dishonourable on Twitter or at rightdishonourable.com. John, where can they find you on the internet?
They can find me at Donkey OK or in a cave.
You can find me at JDE Nichols. We will be back next week. Potentially with Jazza, potentially not. And failing that, we will certainly be back with Jazz the week after that. Thanks very much for listening.